Hello everyone, and welcome to an extra special Taking Stock After the Bell, live from the FT Weekend Festival. We're here at the splendid Kenwood House on the edge of Hampstead Heath. I'm joined, as ever, by my co-host and fellow investment manager, James Hughes. Also thrilled to be joined by Joe Wellman, financial planner at Quilter Cheviot Financial Planning, and Caroline Simmons, chief investment officer at Quilter Cheviot. We thought we'd get ourselves together here at the festival with the view of talking about the great wealth transfer and how that impacts many of our clients, viewers, listeners, advisors, and what it means and what sort of clients should be thinking about and looking out for. And I think it's a really good kind of topic, particularly with the budget upcoming, markets showing a degree of volatility, lots going on in the world. So it's a really good sort of chance, I think, for us to kind of get to grips and dig in a little bit and see what everyone should be thinking about. So, Caroline, I'll start with you, if I may. The great wealth transfer, lovely phrase. What is it? What does it mean?
What is it? So for the UK, it's about £5 trillion of wealth that's going to transfer from the baby boom generation over the next 20 years to the subsequent generation. It is the largest wealth transfer of any generation. The baby boomers obviously having benefited from the post-World War economic boom. Yep. The sort of oldest baby boomers are kind of late 70s now, which is also the average life expectancy of a male in the UK. Okay. It's important to remember as well that it's not only to the next generation, but often it goes via a spouse before to the next generation. And it could be female, because female tend to live longer on average by about 4 years than men. So it's part of a broader piece around essentially the changing face of wealth to younger and a more diverse group of people who will be in charge of the wealth over the next few years, and we need to think about the investments that are appropriate for them in that.
And I think that's important. I mean, at Quilter Cheviot, we manage investments, look after the finances for many clients across the demographic age range. But I think, that sort of late baby boomer in their sort of 60s, late 70s is very much in our sort of core competency. And James and I and Joe sit with these sort of clients every day. And Joe, sort of turning to you, and what sort of options do baby boomers thinking about kind of passing on wealth, what options should they be thinking about in terms of how they go about transferring wealth down to the next generation?
If we look from a tax perspective, so inheritance tax being often referred to as a voluntary tax,
sure.
I say quite often to my clients that I can't fix all your tax problems in one tax year, but I can certainly improve it year after year. So there's certain things that we can do. If we're starting off with gifts, it's probably the easiest one, by doing direct gifting to the next generations. There are certain technicalities with a survival period of 7 years before it falls out your estate. But it's quite important for clients to realize that they should be using, like you've got an annual allowance every year that you could gift, that they should be utilizing. And then if we look at stuff like you can utilize trusts, whether they're gifting money into trust for the next generation, again, nil rate bans, considering that there's periodic tax charges in trust. So that's where someone like us would come in and ensuring that we could potentially utilize more than one trust to make sure that we stay within the nil rate bans. And then you can use family investment companies, especially if it's quite a large sum of money. The big one is probably utilizing pensions. So a lot of clients don't actually know. They think of pensions of something purely when they're working, but you can still contribute the minimum 3,600 gross contribution into a pension. And you can continue doing that until the age of 75. And all of this sounds like quite a little amount of numbers, but if you're taking that for two spouses and you're taking your gift allowances every year, it all starts adding up, and it makes a big difference after quite a few years to continue doing that.
You also to sort of butt in there on the pensions thing then, how is that a sort of wealth transfer issue? I mean, pensions, surely we work and we pay into our pension and we use our pensions in retirement for income,
yeah,
right?
So if we look at the type of clients that we continue to service, a lot of them, the pension is the last resort of accessing, because
right,
okay, it's the most tax efficient solution to pass on, depending on when the client passes away. But if you were talking about life expectancy and clients passing away prior to the age of 75, then they are very lucrative from a taxes perspective to pass on to the next generation. as legislation currently stands, there's no inheritance tax because it's wrapped within a pension, so it's wrapped within that structure.
I like that phrase, as things currently stand. We'll come on to that, I'm sure.
Yes, I'm just trying to pick the right words as such for that. One thing that people miss with planning is that you could actually insure the liability, which for me, it's kind of like a guaranteed lottery win. As long as you commit to continue paying the premium, it's very likely that the funds that you'll get out is going to be substantially more than the premiums that you've been paying. What we find in practice happens is that people leave that to quite a late state in life, where, let's be honest, most people in their 40s, you already know whether you're going to be in a position to exceed inheritance tax or whether you've got inheritance coming to you. So if you plan correctly and you structure and you start from an early age to do these things, you can put protection in place, you know, leave it with written into trust, and then you just need to commit to continue paying the premiums.
Yeah. I mean, he and I are both in our 40s, and I don't think it's crossed my mind to do a whole of life insurance policy.
I've actually had whole of life policy since I've been 24.
Is that right?
Well, I didn't start working thinking that I was not going to make it or not being good. Like, I came out knowing that if I'm going to go for this, I'm going to try and do it good in life. So I've had whole of life policies for quite some time, and I will continue paying them. The final thing is probably to consider that people could look at alternative investments. You can look at your AIM strategy, you can look at your EISs, that kind of stuff,
even
like VTTs that you could utilize to get reliefs, whether you get an income tax relief, you're deferring CGT. So it might not be necessarily that those all qualify for business relief, but if you're factoring in the other reliefs that you could gain, it's protecting the funds for the next generation and then potentially looking at
Well, they could decide to become farmers at a late age and get
agricultural you can get agricultural
relief, which would be close to my heart. But,
I mean, ultimately, there's a lot more available for this wealth transition than there has been historically. I mean, if you think back to generations before, there was maybe a house left and maybe some cash, and there wasn't much else. I think with a lot of clients, they assume that we're in quite a high tax environment. There's not much they can do, but as you've explained, there's so much to do.
So much
and
to do.
And actually, things like pensions are way more flexible. You know, if you think about pensions historically, it might have gone to spouse if you know, one of them died, but that was it, and then it ended after that. I think with SIPs and other types of flexible pensions, as you say, you can keep it in there and pass to the next generation without being hit with an inheritance tax charge. So
100%.
There's lots to think about. I think when I have these conversations with an advisor in a room, clients always come away saying, gosh, there's so much more that we can do that I had no idea about. So it's well worth having the conversation.
Yeah, 100%. I think clients tend to forget that they think of all the vanilla things that you can do. And I refer this quite often where I'm like, our job is not to be vanilla. Our job is to assess the risk and to make sure that we're giving the right advice to our clients based on their objectives and their circumstances. Yeah. And whether we're taking a risk with a very small portion of their funds going into a VTT, an EIS or an AIMS, overall, the tax benefits and the reliefs that you'll get far outweighs the little bit of risk in the overall position that you're taking.
And the lovely thing is there's no right or wrong answer. There's no model way of doing it. It's, as you say, it's bespoke advice to every client, depending on, you know, well, first of all, what they feel, what they want to do. You know, some clients are of the view, inheritance tax, well, if I spend it, there's no tax to pay.
It's, 100%.
First plan, that spend it.
That is clearly the best answer, but none of them do it.
Like, how many meetings you have with clients saying, you just need to spend more?
Well, if you spend it, you get 40% off, effectively. So, you know.
The thing is, most of them, if you think about it, we all have this conversation and we laugh about it, and we're saying, yes, clients should be spending their money if they want to come in under the inheritance tax threshold. But 90% of them won't, because all they're thinking is like, I worked so hard for this money, I want to pass it on to the next generation. How do I do this in the most tax efficient way? And then we say to clients, okay, you're not going to spend it. We all know you're not going to spend it. So let's look at the alternative options that's available to go forward.
And Caroline, and in terms of, you know, if I was in my sort of 70s, 80s, and I had a pot big enough to more than sustain me, you know, what sort of issues and kind of things should I be thinking about and worrying about in terms of passing on wealth in various manners?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously the first point is you need to have your framework. So, you know, what are your aims, your goals, your preferences? Hopefully you've thought about that before you got to 70, but if not, I'm sure Joe can still help even at the later stages.
I do.
and then the second piece really is around communication. So we need to start having those discussions with the family members around not necessarily kind of what wealth there is, because some people don't necessarily want to share that, but about what to do in the event of. Financial decisions and finances generally can be quite emotive for people, and what you do not want is to come to that fresh, not knowing anything about who's managing the relationships or anything about investing, when you are potentially in a difficult personal situation of bereavement or in a power of attorney or newly single or something.
So
you want to be able to say, here is a list of key contacts. This is where this list lives. This is where the will lives. Here are the accountants, here are the lawyers, here are the investment managers, here's the bank account. So that the family know roughly who to contact first.
Yeah.
If you are at a stage where the family is capable and it would be sensible to discuss the assets, then you can also discuss the assets with them, what sort of assets are where. If they are not, it's quite important to still bring an element of awareness of investing to the broader family, and this can be done through pretty much any avenue. If they're quite young, you could do it through a junior ISA,
for
example.
Certainly very popular, we find.
If they are of working age, almost everyone now has a pension through auto-enrolment, and if they're self-employed, hopefully they've been advised to set up a pension. So again, everyone can have some awareness of what investing is, and you need to connect, even if it's just at those low levels, without necessarily what the whole family wealth is, if that's not appropriate. But that communication is so important.
I think that's absolutely right, because I think we've all heard of stories, of horror stories, of people on their deathbeds and wills being read, and next generation have no idea what's happening. And and I think the other issue, though, in a way, you sort of brought it about. It's possible that if you're a spouse, if you're a married couple in your 70s, the odds of one of you living to 90 are actually quite high. So, what we do see actually is that the remaining spouse, if you like, after the first one passes, does live into their 90s, in which case their children are probably in their 60s by that point, aren't they? So, the thing we do see is actually wealth jumping down a generation. You mentioned junior ISAs, that's pretty popular with us, for grandparents funding the £9,000 a year for their little Johnny, or for school fees, which is another potentially contentious issue with VAT on the horizon, but we're not going to make this too political until the end, I'm promised. So I think that's really interesting. Communication for me is absolutely key and really important. And sort of added to that, Joe, I've touched a little bit on it, but pitfalls, what do you see that you really kind of wish you'd got involved sooner and helped to avoid?
So I think there's five things of pitfalls that we see in practice. So the one is failure to plan. So if you think about it, you're going on holiday, you don't just pitch up at the airport and go, I'm here for a flight, off I'm going. Like, you pack your passport, you know what your time is, you arrive 2 hours early, you check in, you've got your luggage, you weigh it with Ryanair to make sure,
that does not happen.
So if you think about it that way, how the hell do you actually think that you want to have a good financial plan, but you don't plan, you're just winging it? Like, it doesn't work like that. You need a structure, you need a plan. So I think that's the first one, people fail to plan. Secondly, what we see quite often is people don't leave sufficient emergency fund. They're quite excited, they want to invest their money, but they haven't actually thought about what surplus do I need to retain in cash? Because the last thing you want to do, especially with CGT changes possibly coming up, is having to access at unfavorable times because of investment markets, or having to realize tax gains in a tax year that you don't want to.
I see that a lot with clients, particularly clients who are quite property heavy. And if they've got buy-to-let, second properties, and then they've got investment portfolios. Now, they can often be short of, I call it liquidity rather than cash per se. But if, investment markets are going through a volatile period and you don't really want to sell down equities because they're down 10, 15%, you don't want to sell your buy-to-let because you can't, because the market's shut, it's going to take 6 months. Where do you go if you've got a six-figure bill, which does happen to clients?
So exactly.
I think as clients get older, the liquidity thing is really, really important. And now, just to take it on a step, now that actually you're getting paid a sensible amount to have liquidity available, whether that's cash short-dated bonds, high-quality bonds, you know, the opportunity cost of holding cash and liquidity is a lot lower than it is, and you've got so much optionality. You can gift it, you can do AIM, you know, I think that's really important.
I think I have this conversation with clients, which is if there's a known financial event, you know, whether that's a tax bill or helping someone to purchase a property or someone is considering buying a property, if they have an amount they know they need to utilise, it's get it out of the market and in cash ready, because yes, you could hold it for another 3 months and yes, you might make, you know, another 4 or 5% or whatever if markets are good, but it's Sod's law.
You can still lose the 4 or 5%.
Exactly.
So that's where the planning comes in. You need to structure knowing the events that come. And to carry on with that, I think another thing is people, they don't have sufficient protection. So a lot of people go, oh, but I'm working, everything's fine. Something going wrong is a lot more expensive than everything going right. So you see that quite often in your late 30s to late 40s, where in that period where you've not accumulated the cash and the pension pots that could take you to basically fund your cost of living. Its protection is essential in those periods. Yeah. And then that clients don't update their wills, they don't update their power of attorneys, they don't update their beneficiaries on their pension plans, where pensions are quite essential, that you've got expression of wish form, you've added beneficiaries to that. And then my ultimate favorite is when people do it themselves. That's also the great one where everyone goes, yes, but I've read so-and-so's blog and I've been listening to podcasts. Like, I can do financial planning, it's not a problem. So I try and simplify and use analogies where I think like all the ladies in the room will know, have you tried to cut yourself a fringe? Like, have you tried to do that? You think it's you think it's quite an easy one where you're like, I'll wet it, I'll comb it, and then I'll cut it, no problem. And then it bounces up when it dries out and you look like an absolute numpty for how many weeks? So the same with financial planning. You don't know the legislation. You don't know the tax changes that are coming in. You don't know what the budget is. It's our job to stay up to date. It's our job to continuously be on it every day and not just listen to one podcast.
Well, they're expensive decisions to get
wrong,
aren't they?
Of course they are. Where the small percentages that you pay for a financial advisor or investment manager to be on your portfolios is so little in comparison to making those mistakes just because you, as an intellectual, intelligent person, thinks that you can do something which is not your job.
I think you've hit the nail on the head, because, you know, we you know, clients do, you know, we do pitch to clients who have been running the money themselves, and you know, in lots of cases, it's, well, look at what the returns have been, you know, I've done a really good job, and then it's, but look at where the investments have been made and look at the gains that are in there now. They're in the wrong structure.
Oh, yes, 100%.
You know, you've actually now got a CGT issue when you could have had it in something else.
Or you could have had a 20 or 40% uplift at the beginning before you made those gains.
Exactly,
which
that. And it's, you know, I often say to guys, look, it's my full-time job to focus on the portfolio and to make the investments. Outside of that, there's a team of analysts, you know, really smart people that we work with that are sector specialists and regional specialists. You know, on top of that, we've got Caroline as a CIO that's instructing, you know, asset allocation decisions with the help of committees. And then that's a full-time job. And then the advising role is a full-time job. If you are sitting at home, whether you're retired or, you know, if someone's full-time working trying to do it, you just can't dedicate the amount of time.
No,
it's impossible.
It's like I don't take on surgery every day because I thought I was clever enough to study as a surgeon. Like, it doesn't work like that in life.
and Caroline, if you know, again, I'm in a position where I want to start passing wealth down to the generation and I've been sensible, so I want to go and see an advisor, whether that's Joe or James or myself or whoever I may be, what sort of things should you be asking them, and what sort of, you know, what should you expect of them, I suppose, is the question.
No, absolutely. Very good question. So what services do you offer? How would it help me meet the goals that I have? What are the risks associated with the investments or the structures? And why are those risks tolerable for me and my goals? What's the cost of the service and how is it paid? And what are the benefits of that?
Yeah.
Can you talk to me in a way that I can understand?
Oh, well, that's a big one.
That is a big one. Can you make it relevant? Can you give me a demonstration of, you know, how something might work? Or can you show me a cash flow model that would explain, you know, my goals and preferences that we've laid out over time? I think those are probably the top four or five things you should be asking.
Yeah, totally. And I guess a lot of what we do day to day, we will sit with clients, and a lot of it is, sometimes you need to pitch it up here and sometimes you need to bring it right back down. And it comes back to if you're passing wealth down generations to younger cohorts, you sit and say, what's an equity? What's a bond? And it is literally, have you heard of Microsoft and Apple? Good, right, it's a good start. And then you get in specifics of, government bonds or whatever it might be, and you start talking about risk, and then you talk about structures, and you have to do it in such a way that, people understand. So that's really important. For lots of clients to kind of make sure they are comfortable in the environment they're with their advisor, to make sure they ignorance is no excuse, I guess, is it, for clients? If you have wealth, you have a responsibility to that wealth.
Absolutely.
Wealth can be very liberating in many senses, but it is also, I sort of do say this to clients, you shouldn't feel embarrassed by feeling the pressure of this over your head, and you have to make some quite big decisions.
Absolutely.
But
it's a responsibility that we are all in charge of for ourselves, and I don't understand it, I'm not interested, my spouse doesn't care, my children aren't interested, like these are all just excuses. If we want to have a chance of meeting our goals, then we need to have an understanding of what those goals are and how we're trying to get there, and we need to have a very basic level of understanding and or take on trusted advisors who can help provide the expertise that we need if we don't have that ourselves. And it is really for each and every one of us to take that responsibility to have our own financial control.
Yeah,
I think an important thing to mention on that, which we see quite often, is there's always one spouse that seems to lead in the financial planning, and that is quite a risk, because we're dealing with clients where, like, I've got a client at the moment whose husband passed away and she didn't have a clue what's going on in the finances. And it's taken me since October last year, since he's died, to try and get an idea of where everything is, consolidating everything, getting documents. We're sitting with directly held shares now, which we need to get certificates for, and we can't get certificates, and now we have to get indemnities. And it's a bit of a disaster where if you were both looped in, even though it's not your expertise and you don't want to really know too much, be present in the meetings, make sure that you at least have a spreadsheet of where is everything, so that if anything does happen, that you can then go to a trusted advisor or use your same trusted advisor to be able to help you through the process. But a starting point, just know where it is.
one of my earlier clients years ago now, her husband was taken unwell quite quickly, a degenerative disease, and he did all the finances, literally everything. She had no idea. So we literally, one afternoon, went into their study and picked out bits of paper, go, well, something from Aviva, we might have something here. And that took, a long time to get hold of. And as you say, having a record, that was in the days of paper, where you had statements through the post. This day and age, Aviva, whoever, send you an email to a portal somewhere, then say it's a password, it's not helpful. So having records and detail, and again, this comes back a little bit about communication, the next generation, get them involved sooner rather than later is kind of my view.
I say to all my clients, even if it's a plan I'm not advising on, give me authority letter, sign the authority letter, because I've got an electronic system where I keep everything. So give me a copy of your power of attorney, give me a copy of your will, because then I keep it on your folder, it's centrally held, it is there. Even if something happens to me, you can contact the company and we can tell you where everything is, because it just makes it easier than to try and look for stuff when you're no longer there.
And somewhat more controversial, we've talked a bit about pensions, we've touched on CGT, business property relief, AIM, trusts, etc., etc., all good stuff. Got a budget coming up in 8 weeks, and obviously we're not here to make specific recommendations what you might or might not do. Joe, what's going to be in the budget and what should clients do now?
This is where caveat.
Wrong question.
This is my personal opinion and not the opinion
exactly.
Of Quilter. So it's quite a difficult one. I am very much in the logical camp, and I'm hoping the government is semi-logical when they think about these things. So I keep thinking, the things that everyone is going on about pension, what pension changes could come in. I think one of the big things that at some point is going to happen is extending the age at which you can access your pension. I get that, it makes sense, because people are taking their pensions too early, paying off debt, and then they've got no money and becomes a burden to the government. I get that, that makes sense, not a problem. But the talks that's been thrown around about changing the tax efficiency on death of a pension and potentially being subject to inheritance tax, I don't know whether that would be one that would actually happen.
That would materially, because my understanding was that back in the day when I started, a tax on pension on death was 82%, was it? Back in the noughties? So the, you know, the advice in those days was spend the money in your pension and avoid the 82%. Whereas now the tax rules on pension on death are quite attractive relatively, and therefore clients tend to use that as a vehicle for passing wealth down.
But you're also thinking of the fact that we're sitting in a position at the moment where we've got an unfunded state pension, the age of that continuing to be just the milepost, we'll move it along even further, because we can't afford for people's life expectancy extending and the amount of national insurance contributions being paid to fund that, the maths don't work. So if you're sitting in a position that you're making pensions unattractive, the burden for the state becomes more.
So I don't
actually think whether that's a solution.
Enrollment and how important that was, and the reason
it
was set up was because the state can't afford to pay for people's retirement.
So shout out to a friend of the pod, Simon French, who was on a month or so ago. He worked on that project in government, the DWP. So that was part of his role there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, you know, to take that away, it puts the onus back on the government again, because if there's not the incentive to do the tax savings, people won't top up pensions. They won't, you know, if they're not getting the relief on the way in the same way, it just won't happen.
And you're also thinking, like, the amount of pension changes that's been made in the past 15 years, simplification is everything but simplification, and the complexity of it becomes worse and worse. Where are we going to get to a point that people can actually advise on pensions, because it's going to become something that is impossible to plan for? And you also need to factor in that this government, I'm assuming, would like another term, where if you're touching something like a capital gains tax, you're trying to, nice word to use, upsetting a small proportion, versus if you're touching pensions and making it not as tax efficient anymore, you're literally going to upset the whole electorate, and then who's going to vote for you next time around? So I think capital gains tax, yes, that's a biggie that's going to come in. I'm very much in the camp that the result that they want from a change in capital gains tax is effectively that they want the gains to be realized. They want the tax to be paid in that 60-day period. And the only way that they'll get that done is by giving a time period,
a grace period,
of saying, okay, on the 6th of April 2025, the tax changes will be X. Because then we're dealing with a lot of clients that's got thousands, if not hundred thousands, millions worth of gains in their portfolios. Now, that type of client doesn't necessarily need to realize gains, because they will have alternative investments and alternative in funds that they can utilize. So the end result, if you change it tomorrow, they're not going to realize, just as they haven't done now, where if you give them and saying you're getting half price tax bill, do it by the 6th of April, all those clients are likely to sell off, start with a new base rate, and then continue.
We're having a lot of those conversations with clients now, because we'll have a lot of general investments, taxable investments, where there are inbuilt gains. And, you know, to your point, I agree with you. It makes more sense to put a rate up from the start of next tax year, so they get a load of tax revenue through of people crystallising gains this year. The flip side of that, however, the precedent is that George Osborne raised capital gains tax in 2010 at midnight on the day of the budget. And that was a very deliberate policy. So there is precedent for the Chancellor to do it on the day of the budget. So there's no right and wrong answer here. It comes back to clients' own circumstances. If you're going to need money in the next 6 to 12 months and you have to crystallise some gains, probably do it before the budget, just in case. Yeah. I would actually point listeners and viewers to David Denton, our technical specialist, of course, Chief. It's a very good seminar last Wednesday online, which I think is available on our website. And it was very good. And he sets out all the history of capital gains tax changes over the years. But that's definitely an area of kind of live talking points with clients.
But
now,
it might be one that you actually discuss on an individual basis, because if you've got clients that aren't going to need the gains, they're not going to need to access, why would you sell off in any case? Like, what would the difference be?
Where
if you need the money, of course, crystallize, you know, all of it, right? You know, realize the gain, pay the taxes, because at least you know it's definite what the amount is, because we all know it's not going to get better. So
I mean, that is the danger with putting the taxes up, the CGT rates up. And again, I've had lots of these conversations with clients, but some clients sort of said, well, you know, in that case, essentially, I'll hold the investments until another government's in.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. It depends on
what. That's quite an extreme view, but I do think some clients will take that view, not just with the assets we manage, but with the buy to let or to the, you know, the holiday home or whatever else, it just won't be sold if, say,
that's why capital gains tax is fundamentally a bad tax, right? Because it puts sand in the gears. You know, if you own a buy-to-let but you want to sell it but you won't sell it because of the tax, you shouldn't own that asset. Somebody else should own it fundamentally. So I have a bit of a bugbear with CGT. So we'll see what the Chancellor brings on that front. But I mean, I think that's probably the most live area of debate.
I guess it comes back to the sort of, you know, the broad framework again. So, you know, you want the framework, you want your investments, you want to see what your goals are that you're trying to achieve. And, you know, taxes are part of the mix, but it shouldn't be the start of it, right? You know, you've got to keep an eye on what you're trying to achieve and then think about the most efficient ways of doing that and not sort of let the tax piece completely dominate everything. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't, you know, invest in anything, which then means you're not going to meet your goals, but you would have no tax liability, but that wouldn't achieve the outcome. So, you know, in some ways, actually, you know, getting a better return on your investments might generate more tax, but it might make you more able to meet your goals.
It's a good tax to pay, isn't it? So, you know, if you're paying taxes, you've made gains and you've done well and you made some sound investment decisions, like, you know, employing Uzi over here, then, you know, well done you.
Absolutely. I think the common I always use with clients is don't let the tax tail wag the dog.
No. Yeah. Oh, 100%.
Start with making the investments work to start with.
I've heard someone say paying taxes is a privilege, which, you know, where you think, I get it. Do we all want to pay less? Of course we do. But if you've got increased tax to pay, it means you've made money. And if you've made money, then our job, you know, we've achieved what we were set out to do. And from my perspective, if I can relieve the tax prior to going into those tax generating investments, then overall it should be a win for the clients.
Sure. And then we'll just sort of finish up, I think, Caroline. Market's been a bit bumpy. It's generally been a pretty good period for investors, I think, the last couple of years, I guess. A bit wobbly in the last sort of month or so. Any sort of, you know, what should clients be kind of thinking, worrying about, you know, what should they expect from here? Or that's a bit of a crystal ball question. 6.2% for the end of the year. You know, what are we thinking about internally, I suppose, is a different way of framing it.
Generally, the outlook is reasonable. For global growth, we're looking for GDP growth around 2.7%. So it's slightly below kind of a long run average. The US growth is higher and slowing, European growth is lower but accelerating, and emerging market growth is generally higher but missing expectations. Inflation's coming back down to close to target in many regions, and therefore central banks are starting to normalize interest rates again, bringing interest rates lower. The market is forecasting around 100 basis points, or 1% cuts from the US rates between now and December. Seems a little bit punchy to me. Yeah, I think it might be more like 0.75%, but we'll see. And on the UK, it's about 0.5% rate cut expected from here to the year end. And then obviously cuts expected into next year. And the reasons, you know, why they're sort of cutting rates, obviously, is inflation's normalizing and growth is slowing in some regions, but is generally okay. And as long as we don't end up in a hard landing scenario, which is when the US goes into recession, then actually the outlook for financial markets is reasonable. So I would suggest sort of mid to high single digit returns expected over the next 12 months from equities and fixed income. Equities driven by the global growth and the earnings growth that you get as a result of that, double digit earnings growth. Fixed income, your starting yields are sort of 4-5%, and then you will also get some capital appreciation as interest rates move lower and the bond yields come down. So again, probably similar rates. So we have a small overweight to equities and fixed income in our portfolios, and then you'd have something like hedge funds in portfolios for a risk mitigation control. So you know, some people think hedge funds are these very high performing assets. They're not. If you use them for their diversified approach, it's actually, you tend to get a return between equities and bonds from hedge funds, and they have a low drawdown. So, you know, they're there for the risk off events. 2022, a couple things went up, hedge funds and oil. So that protected you. So they're there for that sort of kind of risk control element. But yeah, it's a reasonable outlook. As I say, it is volatile because the economy is normalizing. And, you know, the market's very sensitive to every data point around, you know, how much is the US growth slowing and will it be able to do the soft landing or will it not? So things are, you know, a bit jumpy around, but the broad picture looks reasonable.
Yeah, and on that, Husey, I mean, US hard landing, is it going into recession, is it not going into recession? We had US non-farm payrolls yesterday. Do you want to sort of talk our viewers and listeners through that and the sort of highlights and lowlights of that? What did that, you know, how did you feel when those numbers hit yesterday?
I mean, the market took them fairly negatively. The NASDAQ was off 3-4% its worst.
Yeah.
But it's kind of the more growthy names selling off quite aggressively, which, I mean, that was quite interesting because that's been different to what we've seen before. Usually, you know, thinking about rate cuts, those names hold up quite
they
well.
Do,
but
yeah.
It's just a general risk-off day. I mean, the advice would be don't look too much into it. These data points, people are super sensitive to. And, you know, I think the other thing is how reliable is this data? Of course,
yeah.
We need to look at it, but survey attendance isn't as good as it has been.
And that's across a lot of, that's in the UK Office National Statistics got massive problems with the labour market data here as well. So if there's one lesson, don't extrapolate 1 month's data out because it's probably going to get revised two or three times before we know the actual outturn.
Exactly that. And it's, if you think about the way these surveys are conducted, you know, particularly in the US, part of it is still knocking on doors.
No, they phone
ringing,
people up on a landline.
Ringing landlines.
Who answers
a
landline?
Who has a landline?
Right. This is the point. Who has a landline? And
actually, Mrs. Biggin, she has one, definitely.
Yeah, and actually, who opens the door? Most people
exactly
at work. So. Look,
or you have your ring doorbell and you're like, I'm not answering.
Or like me, you forget to charge the ring doorbell and it's always flat, so it doesn't work anyway. So, but of course we need to look at this data, and the revisions are almost more important, but the market gets, when there's a sensitivity around where the economy is at the moment, and we've gone from, really it started with COVID, but we've gone through, this is a very strange cycle.
It is because of the pandemic and we're still feeling the back end of that.
This is not a normal environment.
Yeah.
I think, look, we've had this inflationary period, you know, in 2023 we were guaranteed to see the recession that never came. We've gone into 24, returns have been very good again. I think, again, so a strategist recently was asked, what are you worrying about? And he said, nothing, because the market's worrying about everything for me.
Yeah, it is a bit skittish.
It's very skittish.
Yeah.
So I think you go back to what we do. We think about company earnings. We think about margins. We think about revenue growth. And we select sensibly. I think, yeah, of course, we'd rather the number yesterday was probably more positive than it was. But it's one data point. So that's a very long-winded answer to your question.
That's a very good answer.
Well, I think that sort of the takeaways, unless violently disagree with me if you may, but in terms of sort of great wealth transfer, what do we think? Communicate, get some good advice, think about it earlier rather than later, get the next generation involved, avoid, you know, making really silly decisions, particularly around the investments, but also around tax. Budgets coming up, it's a bit of a lottery, but if you're, you know, if you've got specific things that you need to do, perhaps, then get your house in order.
It's probably worth saying the day after the budget, we'll be doing
we're going live again, aren't we, after the day after the budget. So
we'll be running through some of the highlights.
That'll be fun.
We can see how correct we were with our predictions.
Exactly. CGT rate up, we don't think until next tax year. That's our main prediction.
Beth
the
McKemp, I'm in.
I'm into that.
The band opposite us hasn't started
band
up again.
Haven't struck up, but hopefully they're about to.
Hopefully
we'll have a lovely day. Caroline, you're on the main stage later, so we'll pop in and see that. You'll have a bustling crowd, I'm sure, on the same topic. And thank you to all our viewers and listeners for taking the time out to listen to us chew the fat, and we hope to see you next time. Thanks very much.